Okay, welcome everyone to the Wonder and Awe podcast, A Journey into the Soul. I'm Louis Schwartzberg. I'll be your host. And many of you know me from the films I've made to celebrate life, making the invisible visible by taking viewers on journeys through time and scale and focusing on important issues like Fantastic Fungi, which was looking at the mycelial network and how we're all connected to nature, and Journeys into the Heart with Gratitude Revealed. My work has always combined the art and the science because I really think that that is the intersection where wonder and awe lives. This podcast fills that sweet spot. You know, what I've learned over all my years of filming is that immersion in nature increases our capacity for creativity, kindness, and compassion. And these are the components we need in order to transform our world, shifting our values, which shifts our behavior. And that creates communities that can influence the choices that we make. That's why I'm proud today that this podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute. They're helping to build a loving world. They aim to inspire that by creating programs and research that transforms the world into a more loving home for everybody. And they explore topics like, what does spirituality mean to us? And informs our understanding of ourselves and each other to take action for the common good. You can explore all these ideas and thoughts at Fetzer.org. So today it's my honor to introduce you to Deepa Patel. Deepa is a Sufi teacher, and she also serves in her capacity as international coordinator and the executive director for the Zenith Institute, a four-week Sufi meditation camp in the Swiss Alps, where she guides retreats for young adults. She's also the chair of the Tamasha Theater Company and the Lost Foundation, a bereavement support service for people who have lost loved ones to cancer. Her past roles have included being a music producer for the BBC, a campaigner on HIV/AIDS for ActionAge, and the managing director of Creative Partnerships, a national UK government initiative on creativity in schools. She currently facilitates programs for organizations globally on the art of collaboration, conversation, and contemplation. Deepa, welcome to Wonder and Awe, A Journey into the Soul.
Thanks, Louis. It's nice to be here.
Deepa, I'm curious, you know, when we talked on the phone, you mentioned that you were born in Kenya to Indian parents, and then you moved to England when you were about 10. How did that experience influence you?
The main thing that it's brought up is it's been years of searching for what does it mean to belong. And it was interesting because for a long time I thought belonging was about a geographic place. So I'd never been to India, even though my heritage was Indian. And at 17, I went to India for the first time. And that was the final stage of going, oh, I don't belong here. But what was brilliant was that in my 20s, there was music that was coming out of England at the time, which was a mixture of Indian classical music, dance music, punk music. And when I started to listen to that music, I was like, that's where I belong. I belong in music. And so music has, it was from a very young age, but music has been one of the central things in my life, which I turn to kind of probably every day, both in terms of awe, but also in terms of solace.
So was music the thing that guided you on this path to Sufism?
It was, because Hazrat Inayat Khan, which is the lineage of Sufism that I'm a student of, was a musician. He was one of India's greatest musicians. And he was actually came to England. He was the first Sufi to bring Sufism to the West. And it was very much based on uniting people through music and through harmony. So when I found this lineage, it was again that feeling of like, oh, I've come home, because again, music was so central to it.
Is this a particular branch of Sufism that you're involved with?
So it's come from India. And it's very rooted in four different lineages. But Hazrat Inayat Khan was also someone that brought Sufism and yoga together, or studied that. And when he came to the West, one of the things that he was keen to do was to be rooted in the tradition, but also to listen to what was needed at the time in the West for this flourishing of humanity. So it has a universalism to it as well as a path.
Is music then, I suppose, your pathway into wonder, awe, and into the soul? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, and I can really see how that's developed, which I also think is part of the journey. You know, so the story I told earlier was music was where I kind of said, had this sense of, oh, I belong in that music. And music is still the thing that I go to. But I think where it really connects to the journey of the soul and this idea of awe is really the path now is how to be an instrument for the moment. Some people might say even an instrument for God, but really what does it mean to be that instrument? And I'd say that that was the kind of key, I might even call it the keynote of how I come to wonder and awe on a daily basis to really be able to be present to it, as it were.
And does it also like influence perhaps this connection with breathing and breath for you?
Always. I feel like the most magical and awesome thing in my life is the breath, because of course without it I don't exist. And yet it's the thing that I'm sort of spend most of the day being unconscious of, really, considering that it's the thing that keeps me alive. So that coming back to the breath all the time is a discipline, right? In terms of looking at how to be in relationship to everything in the world, to that connection that you've done through all of your work around gratitude, the breath brings it quicker than anything else that I know. So there's something about really learning where the breath is. I don't think it's just the practice of, can I deepen my breath? It's like, what's my breath like right now in this moment? And as soon as I become aware of it, there's a deepening process that happens. Look, I'm just watching you and thinking, oh, what's your relationship to breath, Louis? How do you relate to this subject?
No, it just pulled me back into being in the present and trying to be in the moment, which is like, it seems like that's the goal of all these spiritual practices in a way. To be present, to be in the moment, it's such a difficult thing to do. I mean, as a senior teacher in your practice, how do you use, you know, what you've learned to share that with your students?
The breath, first of all. And it, of course, there's many practices that you can do with the breath, but the first one is just becoming present to it. That in itself, just like it did with you just now, it brought us right here. Then in this tradition, we have what are called the elemental breaths, and it's a practice of purification. And we connect to the earth breath, the fire breath, the water breath, and the air breath. And just again, practicing those, which actually we see very naturally in ourselves or even in children. Like when we're stable, we tend to breathe in and out of the mouth. When we're teary, we tend to kind of breathe in through the nose and then we just like let out this. When we're in a fiery place, we're like, and we're breathing out. And often what we see, the air breath, which is the breath which is in and out of the mouth, it's often that if you breathe in and out of the mouth, you're kind of like this light, airy, you're not quite grounded. So actually, this practice in itself is like a purification practice, but it's also connected to the elements and it really brings us to it. I think that with your question was about students, and I think there's two things there, which is becoming present, like we've just done, and then often taking that moment to really think about what am I grateful for right now? Does something to us. It's sort of you've done the work of the film and so many other things to show the power of that. there's something that softens, we appear, we come to the heart, which really essentially is the practice of Sufism, the practice of the heart. How do we relate to ourselves, to the world, to each other through the heart? So anything that's going to bring us into that place. And again, it's about awareness. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to be open-hearted. It's like, what is the state of my heart right now? Just that little bit of awareness can take us a long way to feeling that sense of openness, which allows for all.
You know, so currently, like, you know, these are some really strange times on planet Earth in terms of, you know, environmental degradation, coming out of COVID, obviously. There's been a lot of, like, you know, disconnection where people couldn't get together with friends and family to have dinner. And that fear of, is there going to be another shutdown? Or, and, you know, it's still lingering on. There's a lot of PTSD. I'm curious, what do you tell people who feel like they're in this feeling of despair?
I'm going to share a story because I think it's kind of how I'm living to live with this rather than what I tell people. You know, I work with refugees in Africa, and most of the refugee camps that I'm working in, people have been there for over 20 years. In Mozambique and Malawi, there's camps that, one camp that people have lived there for 26 years. Going into spaces like that is quite a thing at this time, partly because those camps are really suffering from the lack of funding and a number of other things that are going on. And I think for me, one of the biggest lessons is, do I have the strength and the capacity to bear witness to what I'm seeing? You'll hear this in Buddhist teachings, but actually not to change anything, to just be open, curious, and bear witness to what's going on. That power to see and be seen, I think, is part of the way that we deal with despair. Now, it might be counterintuitive to say, actually look the despair in the face, be present to the despair. But my own learning has been, the more I'm able to do that, the more I can open to the connection that exists between me and the other person. There's no running away from something. There's no holding back. But there is, I don't think that we can ignore the sadness and the loneliness and the despair that we're feeling. There's something about the acknowledgement of those things that allow us to then move to the next stage of, okay, then what's present here, right? The reason that I keep falling in love with my path every day is because I'm being asked to, can I be present to what is trying to emerge in this moment? What's the creativity that's emerging? What's the awe that's emerging? And there's always something, if I'm clear enough and clean enough to be present, that just allows us to take that next step. And then that allows us to take the next step. I know when I'm in my mind, I'm kind of full of like, oh, these are the solutions. But actually, when I'm present, then I'm here for each step. And I think that's the difference that I see for myself in terms of what we're facing in the world, that it really does require this willingness to be present so that we can be with despair. And then what I'd, T.S. Eliot in his poem talks about, living life not with false hope, but with hope as it truly is, you know. And I think that that's part of what we're all trying to find a way to do. But we can't jump to that hope. That hope comes from a willingness to be heartbroken. And maybe, Louis, that's my question to you. Like, you asked me the question about how are you dealing with the despair? Because, you know, we learn from each other, really. So
I'm interested. I think that what I try to do is find something to be grateful for, because I realize I'm in a negative spiral, and it's only kind of accelerating the more I dwell there. It kind of takes on an energy of its own. It kind of gets faster and faster. It's like something going down the drain in the sink, where it accelerates as it goes down into the down into the tube. So yeah, for me, it's like I got to find something to pull me out of it. you know? And it could be something as simple as, you know, looking at my fingers and saying, I got five fingers that move, you know? Or it could be a lot of times being aware of the light. Even without a camera, I'm always fascinated, like, what is it that attracts my attention? What is it that is beautiful? It's not only like what is grabbing my attention, but why, you know? If there's light, you know, if I say, oh, here's a beauty, there's a flower over there, and I'm going to, you know, walk over and, you know, take a look at the flower, like, but why? I mean, what is it about it? Is it the color? Is it because it's this beautiful red rose? But like, why is red turning me on? You know, and not, and the why isn't academic. It's more like, can I feel the energy of the red wavelength of color and immerse myself into understanding or immerse myself into absorbing the feeling without getting too analytical about it? Because a lot of times we go, oh, it's beautiful, it's a rose, and you move on, you know? And then maybe the academic brain goes, oh, yeah, well, because, you know, red is a color of passion, and they use it in advertising all the time to sell product, you know? And then you move on. But that's not really going deep enough, you know? And so I just try to go deep into anything. It could be a crack in the sidewalk. I'm looking at that crack, and I'm looking at that pattern, and then I'm realizing that that crack looks like, you know, the veins in a leaf, and it looks like, you know, the branches in a tree. And why does the cement crack in the same pattern that other, you know, phenomena does throughout the universe? Is there some type of connection to all of that? That just helps me feel grounded by understanding that I'm just a speck in this grand universe, and that that there is a connection. I mean, my God, there's a connection right now, because you're in London, I'm in LA, and we're having this conversation. So that goes to show that everything is truly connected. So anyways, that's what I use to pull myself out of the spiral. And once I can stop the spiral, I think it's hard to have a negative thought, the positive thought at the same time, right? It's like I've just, there's a default there that I think is something positive. I've really shut down that other mode of thinking, and at least I'm now at ground zero. I'm in neutral, and I can continue. Now I have a choice, right? I can continue to try to find things that are going to make me feel good, or I can continue to go back and ruminate about what I was, you know, spiraling out on. And so it gives me it enables me to pause, and then maybe, hopefully, I'll make the right choice that there's, you know, I need to go into a positive direction, because why not?
That choice is an important thing, right?
Yeah.
Right there. When you were talking, what you reminded me of is this moment where I realized that each rose is different. And yet I often approach roses as they're all just roses, but they're not. And just that in itself takes me to awe and wonder. But I think you have that in terms of mushrooms, and then you're just down this beautiful rabbit hole. It's not a rabbit hole that I don't want to go down, you know. So
the truth to that, Deepa, is, you know, I've been rolling on time-lapse flowers and mushrooms for 40 years nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when I wake up in the morning, thank God, it's something that gets me out of bed, because I'm curious to know in my studio, did the flower open? Now, a lot of people have said to me, Louis, why are you still shooting flowers? You know, how many shots of roses do you have? I probably have hundreds, okay? But they're all different.
Yeah.
They're all doing this dance of life. They're all saying, I'm gorgeous. I'm here. This is my moment to reproduce. You know, I need to get fertilized. And I'm sensual energy beyond belief. I'm red. I smell great. I got this beautiful pattern. I'm designed by evolution to seduce the pollinator to come over to move my DNA so that life energy can go forward. So I am proud and beautiful to be who I am.
Yeah.
I'm not shy, you know?
What I'm also noticing about this conversation is just in talking how much I feel like I'm being changed, you know? So there's something about the richness that comes in a dialogue with someone that just keeps opening the world and deepening in it. And I feel like, well, we could go anywhere, right? We could go to despair or we could go to wonder, and yet it's still wonder at the end of it for me, in terms of the overarching kind of sense that I'm left feeling.
Yeah, if we don't spend obviously enough time in our lives like being contemplative, I suppose, right? And this whole idea of functional consciousness taking over our lives, which is obviously what's happening more and more with the amount of screen time and technology. I mean, we don't have to go into it. Both people that are probably listening right now understand how, you know, the phones and social media have warped our point of view by keeping us trapped in a virtual world that prevents us from being present. And so it's great to be in a conversation with somebody, and it doesn't matter where you're going to go. I mean, you're right. We could talk about despair or the celebration of life, and it doesn't matter, because at least we're talking about what does it mean to be alive? What is being about? You know, can we just pause for a moment and say, hey, here we are, we're alive, we're breathing, and ask the big questions, right? Unveil the mystery. What is life? Who am I? Where am I going? You know?
Yeah.
What happens when we die? You know, I mean, all these giant questions are things we don't think about very often.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up death, because over the years, I think one of my go-to questions is, particularly when I'm kind of in a state of anxiety, I'm just not sure. Is the question I ask myself, which might be morbid for some, is, well, if this was your last moment, what would you do? And it's such a, for me, it's a great question, because it brings me right to the core of what's really going on here. Now, again, it's not necessarily that it answers something, but I'm in a different, looking at it from a different perspective, which is just closer to the real and being here. So I think that plays a major part in awe for me and wonder. That question will often kind of take any situation, and I'm willing to be present to it. You know, the same as, oh, I'm never going to have this moment again. You and I are never going to have this moment again. Isn't that just extraordinary? It's like, then it's like, what am I going to do with this moment with you? That just brings up a different sense of how to live life, really.
It's really funny. When people ask me a lot of times, like, what's the earliest thing you can remember as a child?
Yeah.
And I remember being in the backseat of a 1953 Ford driving in New York City as a four or five-year-old. And I actually remember being conscious enough to say, I'm going to remember this moment. It was like I was throwing a breadcrumb out on the trail. And I told myself, I was just looking out of the back window, like driving at night and sparkling rain and all that kind of stuff. And I told myself that I was going to remember this moment.
Yeah. You know, and what's beautiful is that you saying it, I'm with you in that memory, right?
Yeah.
So it feels alive right now. Like, oh, you just took me to that car seat,
right.
which is quite an extraordinary thing about actually how living an alive memory is, in a way, when we've been conscious in the way that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So when you were talking about death, I'm curious as well, you know, you do a lot of work with people with bereavement support for people mm-hmm. who lost a loved one with cancer. I mean, can you share with me what that work is about and how you feel about it and what you do?
Well, the organization is amazing. It was started because in the UK at the time, one of my friends lost her husband to cancer, and it was a very quick process. And her stepdaughter realized that you could get some bereavement counseling, but what was missing was actually being able to talk about the journey that you've been on when you've lost someone to cancer, which has, it's a particular kind of journey when you lose someone to it. There's trauma, there's all of the things that we know appear in it. But also that what my friend was looking for was a group of people that had had similar experiences that you could share something with. So it was very, very simple thought in a way to create support groups where people could just share their experience. And it's always about simplicity. Often it's like the capacity to listen, right? Our capacity for someone to hold that space so that we can actually, again, just be present to what's arising in the moment, be it tears, be it laughter, be it whatever. And then the other thing was that also there was a need for some social engagement. So being able to go for a walk with people that were in that. So you weren't just in that therapeutic space or in that support space, just doing something like going for a walk or having a cup of tea and cake, that those things were also kind of essential to the support. Now, we're lucky to work with some of the best researchers around grief. So there's a whole process of taking someone through the stages of grief and knowing, of course, that any of these processes are messy. They're never linear, that you're going backwards and forwards. But just someone having that knowledge, of course, has made a difference, as we know, when you kind of have a sense of what's happening to you and how to work with it. But we have other really simple things of being able to connect with someone on the phone who might have gone through the same kind of cancer death as you've been through. So these are very simple things that allow people to actually connect with each other. And then we do a retreat where people can come for the whole weekend. Again, it's a nourishing process. You're looked after. You're in nature. And nature, as I think you've mentioned, is such an important part of this journey, just to be able to connect. So those are all of the, you know, there's a lot of kind of information, but it's really about that cancer has, that losing someone to cancer in this way is special. And we also have, since COVID happened, have been doing it for people that have lost someone to COVID, because there's a slightly different thing, because so many people lost someone to COVID and they weren't able to say goodbye. And they, you know, there's all kinds of things that are packaged in that. So it's sort of offering a slight, much more niche approach to bereavement in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the whole planet is kind of going through that. And we've been showing Gratitude Revealed to nurses at hospitals because, you know, we, I think, have forgotten, like, they were the ones on the front line, and they're the ones now that are going through the PTSD. Yeah. And it seems like we've forgotten the sacrifices that they made in, you know, huge, being on the front line. And we need to, I think, go back and give them our gratitude and thanks for what they did. I mean, the sacrifices they made, not only for themselves, but their families. They couldn't be with their family during that pandemic. And so creating that support amongst each other, you know, is really just having a screening means they can all get together in a room and hang and talk to each other and share their experiences. And what comes up a lot is being grateful for each other. That is what they do. That is what they express. And it's such a simple thing. Like you say, it isn't anything that's really complex, but be able to share that with their fellow, you know, workers, fellow people who went through the experience together, and to be there to support each other is a pathway going forward for them.
It's a different world when we feel that sense of connection and community, right? And I think that was something that the pandemic really showed us. And it is, you know, it's concerning that loneliness is one of the other pandemics that we're dealing with in this world, considering how many of us there are and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, it put a spotlight on that, because this idea about connection isn't a hippy dippy idea. When you couldn't have, you know, friends and family, you know, come together for dinner. We took that for granted. We never thought that that was something that you had to, quote unquote, appreciate. Actually, it's probably a pain in the ass to think you had to get together with your crazy uncles and aunts and everything, right? And when it's taken away from you, then you have a different perspective on all of that. And you realize the human species is critically dependent on connection. That we don't do anything alone. We don't build cities alone. We don't build companies alone. We don't build organizations alone. We don't do anything alone.
Well, I think, of course, that's also true of nature. And one of the things that you mentioned is the crisis that we're in terms of climate, you know, and every little action has an impact on every other. And we still don't fully understand that, you know, that ice melting impacts on famine, impacts on floods. It's like we have the scientific understanding, but we actually don't know it as fully as we need to at the moment. So we're always looking at these two sides of a coin, aren't we, in some ways, of how connection is you know, driving something in our world as the biggest crisis, and yet connection is also what's going to help us to get through that and to come out the other way. So I think the paradoxical, the capacity to hold opposites is a really important part of spirituality. And I think awe does that in a way as well. And the heart, I think for me, is a place to be able to hold opposites. I often think about, you know, what we're dealing with in the world, divisiveness, polarity, not being able to work with these things. Now, I'm not talking about, there's something very real when we start to hold opposites from a place of awe and love. I always worry that these things sound so like whoopee-doopee. Do you know what I mean, Louis? And then how do you actually communicate the reality of what it means to know the process of holding opposites?
Yeah, but I think you're doing it because, like, you are involved, I think, politically in involved with social activism, right? Yeah. So you're not just dwelling in this, like, you know, nirvana of awe and bliss and wonder. So how do you take that energy or peace or comfort or strength, and how do you apply it to the fact that we do live in a critical time right now? Like, environmental degradation has a time clock on it, right? That's the first time, I think, in our history where the clock is ticking. There could have been other things, like, let's say, racism. It's been around for a long time. We kind of hope that generation after generation, things are going to get better. People are going to be more educated and a little bit more open-hearted and all of that. But what's interesting about the environmental crisis is that, you know, the scientists predict that, you know, you got 20 X number of decades, 2-3 decades. If we don't get it right, or a lot of them have said we're past the tipping point. So how do you leverage the strength, insight, and power that you've developed into social active work?
It's such a good question, and it's so easy to sound superficial in it. So I'm just kind of aware of what to say here.
Take your time. Because, you know, when you ask a big question, you shouldn't have the answer at the tip of your tongue. You really need to think about it, you know? Yeah. And I need to think about it as well. I mean, it's like, I'll start off. I'll say that, you know, we are all Jedi warriors. I think we were all born here to, heal the world, and we all do it in different ways, but I need to go back to the well and get my strength, and I need to be centered and strong and healthy in order to fight the good fight.
So the first thing that came up when you asked me that question, and it's terrible, I can't remember who said this, but it might have been Maya Angelou, but it would be good for me to look it up, is we were made for this time. So you've just said that. We were made for this time. That's something that I think keeps me kind of grounded. I'm here for this time. So what am I going to do with my time? How am I going to be is probably an even bigger question. From my small interactions every day right through to the bigger ones, that capacity to be present and not reactive, I think is part of it.
I mean, the phrase I've also heard is that, you know, you chose to be born in this time and place. Perhaps you even chose the parents, you know, that, and if there's any, you know, quote, like, you know, truth or resonance to those ideas, then it puts you on a mission.
I want to come back to music. One of the things that we talk about a lot on the Sufi path is knowing our note. What's the notes that we've come to play? And actually kind of, you know, doing the purification work, getting to the essence to hear that note. And then the work is to be able to play that note, but in relation to all the other notes that are being played with you. So creating that sense of harmony. When you know your note and are willing to play it fully, and then be open and listening to the notes that are being played around you so that you can kind of adjust your note, right? When does it stop? When does it come fully? That I think is the art, as it were. And I science and music are so connected for me in different ways. So I think what I'm talking about is what you had mentioned earlier about that relationship between science and art. That would be one of the answers. And that note, of course, it changes. So it's not like you just play that note, because then there isn't a kind of evolving in it. Miles Davis, one of my favorite musicians, said 20% is about the note, 80% is about the attitude of the person playing it. So I think knowing the note and the attitude comes together. And, you know, he also said, if you think the note, don't play it. And I think what he's talking about there is that willingness to let go of what's known, to open to the unknown for that moment where creativity lives, really. And I would say that that's the other thing that we're all looking at, you know. The shame of it is that our creativity at the moment is commodified rather than really in the arms of what do we do to create a different world where we flourish. But that, I think, are some of the things that I'd say to you. And we see that all the time, of course, in children who are deeply creative in the way that they're engaged with life, fully engaged with life. So,
can you just go a little deeper? What did you mean by creativity is commodified?
Well, I don't think it's, I think we're in a world in which consumption is the kind of driving factor because of the way we think about economics. So we're all, you know, the first question that we ask of anything is, how can I make money from this? Of course, we need to make money, but that literally is often the first question that we ask. And so we don't necessarily engage in crafts or the arts or creativity just as a deeply enriching, like, soul fulfilling life. The first step of it is that. And of course, when you see with people that are deeply creative, that doesn't always matter in the same way, because they're going to do that thing whether they're paid or they're not paid. So there's something about those two aspects that we're really dealing with at the moment, like, you know. And I think we can see that in influencer culture and all of these other kinds of things, like, how can I commodify is sort of the key question that we're asking,
because the world or the industry, having directed commercials for over a decade, I mean, we hire the most creative artists to create a commercial to get you to consume a product. So you have the best art directors, the best cameramen, the best fashion designers, the best lighting experts, the best copywriters, the best everything that money can buy, you know, and these are people that are skilled artists. They are, you know, and they have to make a living. Like you say, you mean we have to make money. They're very talented people. And I had the benefit of working with the most talented people, you know, making G.I. Joe commercials or a Barbie commercial or a car commercial. I mean, it was a way to put my, you know, daughters through school. I don't feel extraordinarily guilty about it, but I'm aware that it was the finest artistic effort that was all focused into a 30-second spot to push your emotional buttons, which nature gave you to have an emotional reaction that makes you feel a certain way to buy a product, you know. And it was a creative journey in its own right, you know. It was, but it makes you aware that those buttons that are being pressed were buttons that we are hardwired to from nature, you know, feelings of connection, sexuality, beauty, you know, all those things are things nobody taught you how to feel. You didn't go to school to learn any of that, but we have, with science, we've learned and testing and marketing, it's called marketing, I guess, right? How to press your buttons in a certain way. How to play music. I mean, look at the music in commercials. My God, you know, it's designed to get you into an emotional state that would make you want to purchase a product. You know. So, anyways, I think what's my point with all of this is to say that we need to be, I think, aware. Have like visual literacy or emotional literacy, or how about beauty literacy, that when you are being manipulated, to be aware of that, but don't go negative on it. Try to say, aha, I see what they're doing. They're using that particular type of music to influence me in a certain way. But you know what? It makes my heart feel really good. And I'm going to actually, next time I hear the violin, I'm going to really, like, you know, let go and really enjoy that long, beautiful note or those chords or whatever it is that you can identify that touched your soul, you know, and not get too hung up that, my God, they're just manipulating the crap out of me, you know?
Yeah, I think, again, that's the journey, right? That we start there and then we learn from that to take the next step, And in a way, that's where that idea of a much more contemplative life comes in, that allows us to do those things. So I feel like those are some of the things that actually, if we were looking at education, is what we need now. How do we teach young people to be present? How do we teach them to learn what you know, you could say, well, what contemplatives throughout history have done, to be discerning, to know how to focus, to be able to listen from a true place of silence, you know, all of those things. I mean, that would be a rich education.
Well, that's the challenge, because right now it's getting, like, you know, the fear of missing out, FOMO, everything with young people, especially on their phones, is, it takes you away from that. I mean, to tell young people, I want you to sit by a stream for a minute, just a minute, and listen, it might be really impossible for a lot of, might be very challenging. Let's put it that way.
You know? We can start with five and work up to the minute.
Yeah. What, 5 seconds? 5 seconds?
5 seconds, right? 5 seconds. I'm just sort of saying, you know, that it literally is five to, you know, build.
I think that if they're willing to do the five, my hunch is they would definitely be interested in doing 10, 20, 30,
exactly.
And they would get to the minute. Because the power of nature is there, and it will seduce you. It will embrace you because you are it. It's just a homecoming.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you have to, like, decide, oh, I like it or I don't like it. You're just going to connect with yourself. Therefore, it should not be a giant barrier.
Yeah. God, I could talk to you all day, Louis.
I could talk to you all day. Okay. So I hope we're not, if we are running out of time, let me ask you, is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to talk about?
Well, there's always love, Louis.
Yeah.
I could talk about love forever. And yet, I feel like actually this conversation has done that. I feel like I've met a new friend, and so love is here. Maybe I don't need to talk about it, but just feel it. So thank you. I really appreciate this conversation.
Oh, thank you too.
I have a teacher who says, well, ultimately everything is a mystery, right? It's a great mystery. And there are times where we want to solve that mystery, and there's times where we just want to open to that mystery. And I think that part of what we're doing is that discernment. Science often is the solving of that mystery. The arts and other things are an opening to the mystery. And we each have that in our own day. Sometimes we're trying to solve it. But the mystery is the mystery. That's it.
Okay, so I totally agree. I think we're both in love with the mystery.
Yes, we are.
And if you can love the mystery, then you don't need the dogma of having somebody tell you what to believe. Yeah. And you avoid conflict where groups want everyone to think the way they think.
Yeah.
Because of their fear of the unknown, and that the mystery is scary. But if you can love the mystery, it's not scary at all.
Shall I leave you with a poem, Louis? Yeah. This is from a woman called Krista Wells. She says, "Dear one, your love of mystery is your act of faith. Take a slow step into the unknown. Allow the old life to come to its quiet end. This is your beginning."
Oh, well, that was a perfect way to, I think, close our conversation. So,
thank you again.
Yeah, I want to thank you for everything that you do, in having this conversation and in easing the pain and suffering with the groups that you work with, being open to all of that. And sharing your insights with me in the world. I really do appreciate that.
And it was lovely to talk to you, because I think you're doing the same. So I think that was just an echo chamber. I could have said the same words to you, which is a good way to end anything.
Well, that's good to know. So when we go into the great mystery, there'll be just more conversation.
Exactly.
We'll just be always bouncing around in the mystery, which will be a homecoming. And there are people like us that we can hang out with. That'd be great.
Well, we're doing it here as well as wherever we'll end up. So
that's
the good news.
It is great. Thank you, Deepa. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute. Helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.